Hello, I'm Keith Pallon, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Coming up on today's program, UN Human Rights Commission says women in Papua New Guinea need better protection. China and the whistleblower. What are they planning to do? We're talking about the whistleblower who disclosed that the United States has been involved in a very big surveillance program called PRISM. Researchers at Sydney University planning to eradicate two parasitic diseases in East Timor. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The United Nations Human Rights Commission says Papua New Guinea is failing in its duties to protect its women. The UN says when it comes to torture and killings, the cultural practice of sorcery and witchcraft are no excuse, and women need immediate protection. Karen Barlow reports.
Helping the helpless can come at great personal risk and despair.
The problem is getting out of hand. I think it is becoming more frequent now.
Lily is a human rights defender from the highlands of Papua New Guinea. She's giving only her first name for fear of retribution. She says there's a lack of basic support for traumatised victims and there's a culture of silence.
People don't talk about it. It's like a disgrace to the community. It is a belief that is so ingrained that people believe that the sorcery exists, and those people whom they are tortured for as sorcerers, they don't talk out. They don't talk about it. Everybody keep quiet.
In a male-dominated society, women are usually victims, and the violence is often described as inhuman. Lily has told a conference at the Australian National University in Canberra that traditional beliefs are being subverted as an excuse for extreme violence.
I think there may be some, but I never heard of my father telling me that people have been tortured that way, have been killed that way, have been murdered that way.
The killings are nothing short of murder for Nancy Robinson from the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
We consider it a very troubling phenomenon that really goes to the heart of the international human rights framework as a human rights violation against women's right to life, a right not to be tortured, and also to lead a life without violence. These are issues that we're aware of, exist in many countries, but we feel that it's inadmissible that by virtue of cultural practices, women's right to life is being violated.
Nancy Robinson says urgent action is needed to stop the violence and protect the victims. She says a woman's safety is not negotiable for states like PNG.
The government of PNG has signed on to many conventions and therefore is obligated to assure the protection. The state, in every case, has a duty to protect, and we feel that that duty to protect is failing. We need to embark on an action plan that will be effective in providing protection to these women as a state duty.
But there is hope. In 2006, after decades of torture and killings, the nine clans and church leaders in the Gor community in PNG's Chimbu province signed a special local law. Gor community member Clara Ball says the locals respected the new law because they made it.
It was so bad in the village, but after this law was implemented, it has come to a stop. The law actually put this sorcery-related killing and tribal warfare to a stop. And the people are now happy with this law.
What are these laws? Exactly what are we talking about here? What has made the difference?
Okay, these laws are the combination of the constitution of PNG and the traditional laws. They have identified the problems that they were facing, and they sort of combined the they combined the constitution of PNG and the traditional law to address the problems that they were facing, and one of which is the sorcery-related killings.
A local Gor community police force was also created and staffed by men and women. Clara Ball hopes other PNG communities will be inspired by the good work of the people of Gor.
If my people at the home are happy, then I'm happy and I'm happy to work, you know. If they're not happy, I won't be. And this law have made it positive that the people, my people, are happy. And I'm proud of that, yeah.
The whistleblower, who disclosed the United States' huge online surveillance program, says he has faith that Hong Kong's judicial system will protect him. The 29-year-old former CIA contractor Edward Snowden is vowing to resist extradition from the Chinese state city. He also has raised new allegations that the United States has been hacking into computers in China and Hong Kong for years. Chinese state media has seized on the report, coming as they do just days after Washington stepped up its accusations of cyber spying by Beijing, allegations Beijing denies. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has given its regular press conference briefing, but has provided little insight into Beijing's thinking on the matter. It says it has no information to offer on whether or not the U.S. is seeking Edward Snowden's extradition or how Beijing would react to such a request. So how surprising are the latest spying revelations? This is the question that Joanna McCarthy put to David Zawig, who is the chair professor of social science at Hong Kong University.
I'm surprised that some of the hacking that's, if they're hacking at a local university here, as Snowden said, I'm surprised. But I'm certainly not surprised that the United States intelligence organizations would be hacking in China. It's clearly a problem when the United States is accusing China of hacking, but I think government-to-government spying is something that's quite common and quite expected. And in fact, you know, the United States has 16 intelligence agencies on its overall collection of agencies, and I think Americans would be surprised if they weren't using those powers or that money to find out more about what's going on in China, just like the Chinese are doing to the Americans. So I don't see that as a surprise. The bigger issue, I think, for hacking and spying, the really bigger issue is China doing it to American businesses. And this, as of yet, we haven't heard that the U.S. government is doing this on Chinese businesses and stealing business technology.
And, of course, the timing here is unfortunate for the U.S., coming just after President Obama has had tough words for President Xi when they met in California over the weekend about cyber hacking. President Xi maintaining he was also a victim of cyber espionage. Now it seems there's some truth to his claims.
Yeah. Well, I think that, first of all, some of the it doesn't seem that President Obama attacked Xi too strongly on the military-to-military hacking or the government-to-government hacking. I think he probably pushed the business side of it, which is illegal, which is another example of China not respecting intellectual property rights. I think the president, the U.S. president, was probably on much stronger ground to be able to make that issue and was probably smart enough to make that point much more strongly, which I think China needs to respond to.
How do you think Beijing would be reacting to these revelations in the South China Morning Post? No doubt, no surprise to them, but perhaps they're enjoying the timing.
I'm sure they're loving it. I'm sure they're loving it. You know, because there's been so much press. I mean, before this was becoming the cyber summit, right, in California, when there were so many other issues that people wanted the two leaders to talk about it, particularly the broader issue of the relationship. But the press just would not stop on the cyber issue, and American government officials, congressmen were all pushing the cyber issue, and a big point about breaking in and stealing information from the U.S. Department of Defense. So, and I think the Chinese probably got quite tired of it, and knowing what they knew about what the Americans were up to. But they, for some reason, didn't come back and sort of blare it all over the Western press. I mean, they did say it happens to us, too. And now, as you said, we know that it's true. It did happen, does happen to them a lot. This is, you know, from Snowden's view, this is the widest technology, you know, collection effort in the world.
There has been a lot of speculation in the US media about why Edward Snowden would choose Hong Kong as the place to provide him refuge, particularly given that Hong Kong does have an extradition treaty with the US. Are you surprised that he's found himself in Hong Kong?
Well, he's sticking by his story. I mean, Hong Kong is a place where people speak out pretty freely. which is one of his points. I think it's a place where the rule of law is in control here. You know, he's going to get a good hearing in the courts. He's going to get a very good hearing in the courts, and that may be the reason he did it, which is he wanted to go to a legal jurisdiction that he felt would be supportive. It's also a place where people have said, and I think it's true to a certain extent, that there's a possibility for political asylum. On the other hand, you know, he also needs to recognize, which he himself in the interview said he recognizes, you know, that the legal system here has sent out many people back to the United States. As you said, the extradition treaty exists, and it's been pretty, the Hong Kong courts have been pretty responsive to the Americans, so he could find himself on a plane back to the U.S.
And what has been the public reaction in Hong Kong? I understand that some civil society and human rights groups are planning a protest to support Edward Snowden in Hong Kong.
Well, this is that's one of the reasons he came here. This is a society, you know, in 2003, when the Chinese government started to put some pressure on, wanted to push through for a new national security law here in Hong Kong, 500,000 people took to the streets saying that they would not accept that, and they actually stopped it. So in that sense, he's really coming to a society that has demonstrated an ability to stand up to Beijing and say, you know, we don't want to succumb to your new laws, which will constrain our freedom. So in that sense, I think he's picked a good place. But again, it is a place that's run by law, and the lawyers and judges and courts will make a decision as to where he's going to wind up. I don't think Beijing's going to interfere on this, and I think that the courts won't necessarily give in to American pressure if they think that he has the right to stay here.
Researchers from Sydney University are aiming to eradicate two parasitic diseases prevalent among children in East Timor. The researchers have teamed up with the Rotary Club of Sydney to raise funds to kill off the disease within 5 years. And they're raising awareness of the cause with a painting created by the East Timor Prime Minister, Shahango Gusmao, while in prison during Indonesia's occupation of East Timor. Sarah Everingham has the story.
There are many competing demands for health spending in East Timor. The University of Sydney is spearheading a program which targets two parasitic diseases which are prevalent among children. Peter McMinn is a professor of infectious diseases at the University of Sydney.
We initially have focused on two diseases that are potentially eradicable. Filariasis, which is a disease that causes elephantiasis, which is a chronic and irreversible swelling of the limbs, and hookworm. Both of these diseases are parasites, worm parasites, that can be cured with treatment.
Peter McMinn says the diseases are known as neglected tropical diseases, but he says the effect of them on children can be devastating.
Certainly in the case of filariasis, it's one of the most important causes of chronic disability globally. Similarly with hookworm, which is an intestinal parasite, which causes, it infects mainly children, and the worm, once it becomes an adult, feeds on blood and competes for food with the child so that it can make malnutrition worse and also cause anemia. And the main effect of chronic infection with hookworm is that the child is underweight and anemic and often has trouble concentrating in schools.
East Timor's ambassador to Australia, Abel Gutierrez, has seen the impact firsthand.
I was lucky I never got the disease. But those who were around me, the relatives and other people, it was debilitating, yeah.
The University of Sydney program is aiming to eradicate the diseases by treating East Timor's population with an antiparasitic medication over 5 years. Professor McMinn says the treatment will need to reach at least 80% of the population.
And in Timor-Leste, that's a challenge because between 20 and 30% of the population are what we call hard-to-reach populations. They live a long way from a road and generally have to walk anything up to 2 to 3 hours to obtain healthcare, or in the case of children, to attend school. So What we want to do with this program is take the medications to the villages.
The plan is to train Timorese health workers to deliver the program. The initiative has been backed by the World Health Organization and international drug companies, and the Rotary Club of Sydney is helping raise funds. The club hosted a recent fundraising event where items donated by East Timor's former president, José Ramos Horta, were auctioned. A painting donated by the former president was on display and is being used to help raise awareness for the cause. East Timor's ambassador to Australia, Abel Gutierrez.
The painting is very interesting. Our Prime Minister, Nana Gusmão, who was then, you know, the leader of the resistance, and he was imprisoned in Jakarta. Yeah, he did this painting for his friend José Ramos Horta for his birthday. And so he painted that in the prison, and then somehow the painting was smuggled out of the prison and went to New York.
Professor McMinn from Sydney University says the painting by East Timor's Prime Minister Xanana Gusmão is of significant historical value.
The front of the picture is a beautiful painting of a traditional house in East Timor, and on the reverse of the painting is a dedication from Xanana Gusmão to José Ramos Horta on the occasion of his birthday, and also urging him to keep up the effort to free East Timor.
Even though José Ramos Horta donated the painting, it will not be sold. Once it's been used to raise funds for the health project, the painting will be returned to Dili to go on display at East Timor's National Resistance Museum.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Indonesia's booming economy has caught the attention of luxury brands. The latest figures from the business magazine Global Asia show there are nearly 10 new billionaires in the country this year. Supercar makers are already thriving in the capital, Jakarta, but now super luxury yacht companies are also moving in. George Roberts has more.
In the world of luxury yachts, this is a humble beginning. Brands have come from as far as Europe and Dubai to test out new waters.
This is the first boat show in Indonesia. So I'm sure that's like after 2 or 3 years, it will be booming.
Apparently they see something in the market, so they're willing to sacrifice, come all the way from all over the world.
Yachties are hoping Indonesia will take off. With more than 17,000 islands to explore, it's tipped to become a better marine playground than the Caribbean. There's also a lot of potential for luxury customers.
We read about Indonesia before deciding to come to this boat show, and we understand that there are a lot of billionaires here, and people also start to discover the marine luxury yacht.
According to business publications, the number of super-rich Indonesians has climbed dramatically.
There are about 40 billionaires in Indonesia, with 10 of them joining the list just this year. So it's little wonder that the luxury yacht industry has its eyes on this market.
The sudden surge in wealth is being attributed to property price inflation. That's also driven up living costs for Indonesia's poor.
It has created a big gap between the haves and the don't-haves. And the danger is that if this gap continues to widen, the gap of inequality between the rich and the poor, within the next 5 years or so, it will create a political issue.
For every billionaire here, there are another 3 million Indonesians living in poverty.
From yurts to skyscrapers, horseback to automobiles, Mongolia is at an exciting moment in history. But in the midst of unbridled growth and the mining boom, Mongolians acknowledge they face big challenges, a view shared by many, also an Australian doctor by the name of Alessandro D'Amaio. He is currently in Mongolia making a short film with NCD Free, a global social movement against non-communicable diseases like diabetes and heart disease, which he founded with his brother. Richard Erwart speaks to Dr. Alessandro D'Amaio for more.
I'm a doctor and an academic as my background, and so traditionally the way that I communicate with the public and try and stir up ideas and it is through academic publishing. But of course, when we're talking about the leading cause of global death, this is an issue, as you mentioned, non-communicable diseases, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, lung diseases and mental health. They kill more people than any other cause, and in fact a person in the Pacific, for example, is 8 times more likely to die from one of these diseases than from an infectious disease. And in Mongolia, just like in Australia, cardiovascular disease is actually the leading cause of death. But there's very little understanding both at a population level and also at the level that I work at with in terms of global governance and the UN and governments, that this is a major issue facing developing as well as developed countries. So it was earlier this year I was actually in Melbourne and having breakfast with my brother, Giuseppe, who's director of a creative consulting company and design firm in Melbourne called Local Peoples. And he was sort of talking about this, and I was lamenting about the lack of societal and political action on the leading cause of death, as I mentioned. And he sort of said to me, Sandra, this doesn't sound like a public health issue. This sounds like a branding issue. And we need to change the way that you're communicating these messages with the public. And that was absolutely true. And so we were communicating brilliantly across the global level with other academics. But beyond that, it was very difficult to communicate the concept that these are not diseases of the future. These are not diseases of rich, fat, old, lazy men living in Australia. These are actually major social, cultural, political and economic challenges for countries like Mongolia, where I've done my PhD and focused on these diseases. So we decided to start a global social movement driven through social media and focusing on the millennial generations, focusing on trying to use, as I mentioned, sort of new media, emerging media and media platforms such as film, but also through Facebook and Twitter and other technologies to try and connect with a new generation and really bring a call to action on this issue.
So do you get the sense that in a country like Mongolia, which is moving at a very rapid pace on the back of this mining boom, that there's such a fundamental issue as the health of the nation is being left behind to some degree, and that's where you can step in with a film like this?
Yeah, so the film that we're trying to make actually focuses on a young, inspiring change maker it happens to be a doctor, but her work is actually outside of medicine, Byamba. She's a young cardiologist trainee here in Mongolia and grew up in the Soviet times and then has seen the transition to a free market capitalist economy. And with that change has seen enormous transitions in the country's health, wealth and also the lay of the land, the structure of the city, and the level of urbanisation. This is a country that really is the economic growth is eclipsing most countries. They had 20% economic growth in 2011, about 12% last year. It's one of the fastest urbanising countries in the world, and this all makes an enormous impact on their health. They've seen a flood of foreign food and processed food coming into the country. People are moving from yurts and from horseback to cars and apartment living. And so with the lifestyle change, the diet change, but also really a fundamental lack of opportunities to have a healthy lifestyle and to make healthy decisions, it's leading to a rapid rise in these diseases and also the risk factors such as childhood obesity.
So do you see this film, if you like, as the prototype for one which could apply to many countries around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a story that is meant to... that is going to be launched in Melbourne at the Melbourne Festival of Ideas in early October, and about a week before we're going to have a launch in the US at Harvard and bring Byamba across to also present the film to the audience, because the idea is really to take this message to a global level, both in terms of politicians and policymakers, but also in terms of speaking to societies across a global level. This is the leading cause of death in almost every region and every country of the world, and it's expected to double in the next 30 years if we don't make some major changes to the way that we live. But importantly, it's not just about poor decisions. It's, you know, this is an issue that's deeply linked to poverty and to a lack of opportunities for making the right decisions.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, please do so at pcjmedia.com. Once again, Focus at pcjmedia.com. If you want more information on these and other stories, you can check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So do go and check it out. Listeners right now tuning into this program in Southeast and East Asia, I want to remind you on the 15-minute weekly edition of the program that you can catch Sundays at 13 hours UTC. That's Sundays at 13 hours UTC to 14 hours UTC on PCJ Radio International's transmission to that part of the world. The frequency for that is 11835 kilohertz. That's 11835 kilohertz. PCJ Radio International Asia Pacific service on 11835 kilohertz with a 15-minute edition of Focus Asia Pacific presented by Andy Sennett. So hopefully you can tune in to that. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, this is Keith Pallon wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Take care, everyone. Today we're going to end off with a little music from India. So enjoy. Bye-bye. La 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 la